In introducing the program, I mentioned that Philip Stoker is delivering not one but two papers, and one of them asks, where have all the adults gone? And I'm fascinated to know what Freud would have said about some of the so-called adults leading the free world who seem to be stuck in adolescence. And then, of course, the important question is, how do we go about changing the current political climate that is based on generating fear of the other and feeding an anxious population with false truths as they set out? They seek a life raft in the storm. Philip, two L's, I'm pleased to see. Philip Stoker is a psychoanalyst and a fellow of the Institute of Psychoanalysis, and he joins us on the line from London. Welcome, Philip.
Thank you very much, Philip.
Before we get on to solving the problems of the world, give us a bit of background to your theories. You believe that we have three drivers: curiosity, love, and aggression. I would perhaps add a fourth, which is our fear of death. But tell me about your three: curiosity, love, and aggression.
Yes. Well, Freud began this idea about drivers building the mind by talking about, well, initially he talked about libido, the sex drive, but he changed that to the life instinct, which is essentially love, and then developed the idea of the death instinct. So it links a bit with your fear of death. But I would rather think of that as aggression, or possibly aggression coming from hatred. Alongside that, I would add curiosity, because Freud said that the start of the development of the mind, the baby is organized by a wish to avoid unpleasure. He called it the pleasure principle. And for him, this was the reason why a child will start to split the world in the way that I would describe as fundamentalist, and out of which the child, coming in touch with reality, is forced to come to terms with truths about the world that he's living in, that then develop further building of the mind. The only problem with Freud's theory is that he doesn't quite account for why any baby would actually face reality. And for me, if we think about curiosity as a driver, that explains why the child starts to look outside. And it's also key, it seems to me, to understanding the difference between what Bruce was describing as Margot Kidder's ability to think, as against the absolute inability to even face what he described as an incendiary situation for what it is. And these two things, it seems to me, these two states of mind happen because there's a loss of curiosity, and instead what is substituted is certainty. And this tends to happen to all of us in the face of anxiety. So that the moment that we feel overwhelmed with anxiety, we are designed, it seems, to retreat into some kind of state of certainty. Now, you can only recover from certainty if you have a capacity to link to a part of you that encourages you to be curious and interested in what's really happening.
You know, I suddenly have an image of a baby looking at its own hand. Do you know the way tiny babies are so fascinated by their own fingers? They're starting to look out into that wider world. But many people stop looking out and look ever inwards. We've just had a cycle of suicide bombings performed by children, young children in neighbouring Indonesia. So let's look at the role of beliefs.
Yes. Okay, so the way that I see belief is that there are two levels of belief. One is when you know you're believing something, and the other is when you don't realize it's a belief. And this was first described by a British psychoanalyst called Ron Britton, who apparently, like many of us, when he was young, was told that Santa Claus didn't exist. Father Christmas was no real person. And he instantly, it appears, realized that he had taken it to be a fact that there was a Father Christmas. And so he instantly discovered that actually this is only a belief. I'd also asked the question, what other beliefs had he inside himself that he took to be facts? So that's an unconscious belief. An unconscious belief is experienced consciously as a fact. And an awful lot of fundamentalism derives from beliefs that are not taken to be beliefs, but are taken to be facts. And facts are very, and the sense of certainty that goes with facts, are very comforting. So when you talk about the shocking example of children as suicide bombers, I mean, children and adolescents faced with anxiety would prefer certainty rather than struggling with not knowing. So if somebody comes along and tells them with conviction that certain things are true, this provides enormous relief. And so the child or adolescent will accept those what are essentially beliefs as fact and organize their lives around those facts.
Philip, what does Freud say about group psychology? Do groups behave in the same way as the individuals you're describing?
Well, that's what I think is so interesting, the way that we are affected by being part of a group. So Freud only spoke about groups in one paper, which was his Group Psychology and the Development of the Ego. But the group psychology part of what he was describing, he was talking about leadership, groups with leaders. And what struck him was that unless there is a leader, then a group will behave in a very irrational way. And the leader provides a direction, and so people will gather around that, because the experience of being part of a group creates of itself massive anxiety. So that in the neoliberal theory about the free market, you will be aware that the assumption is that human beings, individual human beings, behave rationally. Well, Freud initially, and then studies since then of groups, will tell us quite the opposite, that in the face of group dynamic, no individual behaves rationally unless they are able to find something in themselves, like Margot Kidder obviously did, that allows them to think. And I suggest that that thing that they find within themselves is the mechanism that leads them back to being interested and curious.
Okay, let's talk about the importance of thinking in this sense.
Well, the way that I describe thinking is, again, it's a classic psychoanalytic idea. It was developed by a chap called Wilfred Bion. And really, it is the experience of stimulation, whatever it may be, wherever it may come from, arising in the self that then generates a need to understand what's the cause of this stimulus, what's happening. And so thinking is the mechanism by which something that is not known but experienced as a feeling can be processed so that some kind of understanding arises. Now, that requires a tolerance of not knowing. It requires a tolerance for some time of a frustration about not being sure what's happening. That's what I call thinking. And it's essentially unconscious. It happens without our conscious interference. The problem, of course, is that because we have developed conscious minds, which in a way mimic what's going on unconsciously, we prize the conscious version of thinking. The problem with the conscious version of thinking is that it can be very circumscribed, so that it doesn't actually require a sense of not knowing and then a process that follows the not knowing. Very often, it comes from an idea that, as I said earlier, could be an unconscious belief, which feels like a fact. And then what you get is often very complex processes of thought designed entirely to confirm what is held to be a fact. And that's the difference between what I would call real thinking, which manages not knowing, and this kind of thinking, which is all about the pursuit of proof. And you can always test it. You can ask yourself the question when you hear somebody presenting something, are they open to the possibility that something else might be going on? Or is it simply that what's going on is a question of there's either right or there's wrong?
I'm talking to Philip Stoker, who's a fellow of the Institute of Psychoanalysis, and he's delivering the keynote address, in fact, two of them, at the Freud Conference in Melbourne. That's Freud Conference 2018. Let's look at the phrase a state of fundamentalism. Please describe it.
Yes. In the earliest development, the child, first of all, overwhelmed by feelings, because it's important to remember that when you are born, there is no internal defensive system yet, which means that feelings are overwhelming. They are not damped down by what we would describe as a defensive system. So the child overwhelmed with feelings will decide either this is pleasant or unpleasant and splits the world into good and bad as a result of that. The problem with that is that it develops a universe in which the best place is to be with the ideal rather than in hell. The governing principle of that is pleasure. I want to be happy, not unhappy. And the language that I'm likely to be able to use is going to be one that defines why I am either happy or unhappy, which is only the language of blame. So it creates a certainty, a state of certainty, out of which decisions can be made in essentially an omnipotent way. This is the earliest stage of development.
I'm sorry, now, in an omnipotent way? What do you mean by that?
In other words, magically. So I'm either going to magically be perfect or somebody is magically trying to stop me being perfect. But there is no understanding of a process because that would involve something in between the two extremes of ideal or hell. There can be no in-between in this state of mind. So the process of thinking is all about trying to maintain oneself as identified with the ideal, and therefore anything else is felt to be an attack. And just to say about the sense of attack, actually, that at this stage of development, and I'll sort of, in a minute, I'll say why I call it fundamentalist, but the anxiety that the infant feels is essentially anxiety about his survival. It's a life and death thing. And it, again, is unmitigated by any kind of defensive structure so that it feels absolutely enormous. Now, in that state, as I say, there is only right or wrong, and that's the state of mind that I believe is what we describe when we talk about fundamentalist and fundamentalist thinking. There are only two positions, and George W. said it very clearly after 9/11, frequently. In fact, he would say, if you're not with us, you're against us. I'll say this another time. If you're not with us, you're against us. And he would say that continuously, which made it very, very difficult.
As you quoted him, I felt a familiar chill of dread.
It was, isn't it? But it is, isn't it? You know, it's like when Margaret Thatcher sank the Belgrano and then had to answer for it. And she said that we have to be certain at these moments. It is terrifying to hear people talking like that. And very, very difficult when you are talking to somebody who's in that state of mind not to collapse into it yourself. I mean, for example, people like Richard Dawkins and the late Christopher Hitchens were often criticized for sounding as evangelical as the religious people that they were criticizing.
They were both both been on the program on many occasions, and we
are
the three of us are fellow atheists. But I was often critical of both Christopher and Dawkins' version of irreligiosity.
Well, I think it's I would agree with you, and the reason, however, I would do it with a bit of compassion, because I think it's very difficult to find a way to speak to somebody who is coming from a position of certainty without finding yourself collapsing into a similar kind of language.
Mm.
So that you come back at the certainty with another kind of certainty, and that's hopeless. That gets us nowhere. So the question would be, which is presumably the one that you were asking behind all of this, how does one find a way to have a conversation with somebody who's in that state without yourself falling into sounding certain and using the same language, which I call a language of blame?
Is it possible?
Yeah, and the nice thing about my trade. I mean, I'm a psychoanalyst, but I'm also an organizational consultant. So that's why I think I'm bringing the group dynamic in when I'm talking like this. But in terms of the psychoanalysis part of my profession, I do an awful lot, or have done, an awful lot of work with patients who are stuck in that kind of state of mind. And we know that if you can tolerate the urge to argue with them and instead talk to them about a part of themselves, or talk to them knowing that there is a part of themselves, that's probably a better way of putting it, knowing that there is a part of themselves that can be curious, the aim is to inject curiosity. As soon as you start to inject curiosity, it is impossible to hold on to the fundamentalist state of mind. So it is possible to speak to somebody in that state of mind and reconnect them with a drive inside them of curiosity, which allows them then to start to think again. So it is possible.
You're not the first person on the program to link neoliberalism with well, deeply unhappy states in the individual and, of course, within society. So clearly, in your view, neoliberalism has made matters much worse.
I think it's very interesting, this, Philip, because I said earlier that the anxiety that dominates the fundamentalist state of mind is the anxiety that is about life and death. Okay, so it's the most profound anxiety, and it's what I think you were referring to when you're talking about the fear of death. It's a profound anxiety. Now, I think that the, at one level fascinating, at another level horrifying thing that neoliberals have done is to substitute for that anxiety a different name, which is wealth, which is money. So what did neoliberals do? They decided that the freedom to use capital was the same thing as freedom. And as soon as they did that, they substituted for fear of death, fear of my survival and so on, fear of not having the right amount of money.
Philip, on that fascinating note, I'm afraid we've got to leave each other. One Philip.
Oh, that's a shame.
One Philip with another. Philip Stoker, psychoanalyst and fellow of the Institute of Psychoanalysis. And yes, as I said at the outset, Philip will be speaking at the Freud Conference in Melbourne on Saturday the 26th of May. And yes, we will put up a link to the conference on the website. Thank you very much, Philip, who's speaking to us from London. LNL on RN.